Good morning, everybody. As Randall just said, I've spent the last 15 plus years on large-scale analytics problems. My background is in telecommunications and electronics, and as such, I early on got into projects with telecommunication providers to process CDR clickstream data, call detail records at various levels, which in the early to mid-90s were a pretty big problem in terms of how to hold a year worth of call detail records in a single system and analyze that and gain insight and perform analytics and simulation on top of that. And so early on in my career, I had the great opportunity to work with a telco provider in Europe to do just that, to take 13 months of call detail records, load them up into a massive system. Massive at that point in time was probably something that fits on a single hard drive today. 2 terabytes of data was a lot, 1990, of course. And we performed what-if scenarios. We performed pricing analysis. We re-rated every single call made in a year based on a new pricing model. We recalculated the distance of calls. We rebucketed them into different time zones, into peak, off-peak usage, and such things. Very simple, actually, if you think about it, but a very complicated problem just because at that point in time, we were dealing with billions of calls, of course, in a single system. And anything with a billion in it was a big problem. So very interesting problems to solve. Now, what is billions has become hundreds of trillions today. And my career has taken me from the telco, from the call detail records, all the way into internet, where our problem is clickstream data and various levels of clickstream data. And I'm gonna try to take you a little bit on a journey here, what we're doing with extreme large-scale analytical systems at eBay, what we're trying to do, how we are processing the data and the insight we are distilling out of that data, and how we are managing these systems, and how we came up with a way to doing so that is probably very different than most corporations in the US or around the world are doing that today. Very quick, I don't want to keep you too long. Pierre Omidyar founded eBay in the mid-1990s, and he has founded this company based on three core values. And it's really about that philosophy that is really driving eBay and what we're doing in our decisions. And it's around creating opportunity for people around the world on how to trade goods, how to sell and buy items, and how to take friction out of a marketplace that was very inefficient at that point in time. We care because we know if our infrastructure is not working, if our services are not working, there's millions of people that are doing transactions that are impeded by that, right? And we feel that we can make a difference in the world. And all of that is based on the principle of that we believe that people are basically good. Now, it comes with a lot of interesting challenges and problems to implement a system like that. But that was the basic idea of eBay, right? And that was about 15 years ago. And now eBay is a very large multinational company. And if you look, the largest brands that we own, obviously, out of probably 20 different brands are certainly eBay and PayPal. PayPal recently added on Bill Me Later. There is a lot of other internet properties that are part of the eBay family, including StubHub, Shopping.com, Rent.com. There's a lot of classified sites, especially internationally, that have become part of the eBay family over the years. If you look at that, eBay continues to be the largest online marketplace where people from all nationalities come together to trade goods, to sell anything from used to new items. We have about 88 million active users. there are at any given point in time hundreds of millions of active items on the site that are being indexed, that are being updated by our customers. There's a lot of unstructured data in play, as you can imagine, because if you look at the listings and items and products that our sellers put up, they are pretty much in charge of how they want to describe and market their products, right? And so a very interesting challenge is coming out of that. Pair that up with the world's largest online payment processing system with PayPal that allows people to easily transfer money between their accounts, between countries. Again, the idea is to take the friction out, make it more secure, not have to give out the credit card. And again, millions and tens of millions of active users. I think we have far surpassed those last year's numbers of 75 million active users. Between the two, each have several hundred million accounts. Now, not all of them are active, as you can see here, but for our analytical systems, nevertheless, we have to deal with hundreds of millions, approaching a billion different unique accounts that are all interrelated with each other, right? That all have a certain history and data with it. And so anything you do at eBay when it comes to data is naturally very big. Just a few things that we are very proud of is Newsweek rated eBay last year as one of the greenest companies in America. We have a focus on green in the company. We have a green team. We use solar power to power our facilities. We just had an event recently to introduce cells to power data center with natural gas and produce power on site. There's a lot of focus at eBay at being carbon footprint neutral, offsetting the carbon footprint that we are creating. And as such, you will also see we spend a lot of time looking into optimizing our systems and minimizing the footprint that we create in the first place. Trustee rated eBay last year as the most trusted company in the US based on a survey done by them. And I think the year before we were in the top five. That means a lot of us to us. We process obviously a lot of customer data, and we hold data and security standards to the highest level. And as such, we have been very proud last year to receive that honor and be rated as the top leader in information security for that. And then 2 years prior, eBay just received the National Medal of Technology and Innovation from the US president. That's something that is rather rare for our type of companies. I think eBay was the first internet company that ever has received this kind of technology for its innovation and its values. And as such, you can see there's a lot more than just the transactional business that we're focusing on. We're trying to do it in the right way, and we're trying to really encourage the use of green technologies and optimize our footprint in what we're doing. One thing that people sometimes don't see if we get compared to other large internet properties is eBay is a little bit of a unique animal. We trade, or our customers trade items in over 50,000 categories every second. Anything from cars to jewelry to pets dispensers to shampoo, you find pretty much any good in the world is listed on there. Again, at any given point in time, there is several hundred million of these items are online and live. What makes that a little bit different than most other places is at any given point in time, a seller can come in and list a new item or 10,000 new items, modify the terms of those items, and at the same point in time, our search results have to be near real-time accurate, right? they are within, usually within seconds to minutes, updated in terms of what our sellers are providing, which is a very different search engine processing, for example, than what you see in some of the internet search engines, where the real-time aspect is becoming more and more critical. But our systems for the last 15 years have been built around pretty much real-time of that processing, right? And it creates a lot of data, and I'm just going to jump right into some of our technology stats just to give you to ground this conversation in terms of how big are these numbers. And I'm only talking about the analytics systems here. The analytics systems are the ones receiving pretty much 100% of data feeds from any server, any database, any processing engine, any risk model, anything that creates data, it goes into these systems. These systems produce more than 50 terabytes of new incremental data every day. And that in itself comes with some interesting challenges. How do you collect that data? How do you process it? How do you ensure data quality, consistency? We have over 100,000 data elements in our analytical systems. Those 50 terabytes translate to more than 150 billion records a day. And if you do the math, you are quickly into the trillions. Our largest analytical systems have in excess of 50 trillion records in a single table, file, however you want to call it, that gets analyzed and processed by our analysts. We run about 50,000 logic chains every day to process that incoming data. We have more than 5,000 users accessing that data. And one thing that you will see at eBay is, we've called it before data democracy. We're really about open access to data to our analysts and users. As long as your security clearance allows you to see data, you will have access to that data. Of course, we treat personal information, we treat financial results, we apply security around all of these things and fence them off, of course, right? But as long as it is internal public domain, you get to see it, right? There's no such thing as, marketing has their own data on their own system, and risk has their own data on their own system, and if they want to talk to each other, they have no way to seeing it. We are about exposing data to everybody in the company that needs it. We do this with some very large systems. We run basically two massive MPP clusters in an active-active environment that are both dual-loaded at the same point in time, workload-balanced, and they process, overall, these systems process about 50 petabytes of data a day. That's physical reads and writes from our storage infrastructure. And if you do the math, that is a lot of data. And one of the biggest problems that that companies like us have is the fact that you really need to balance your systems, right? Our problems are very I/O intensive. As such, we need massive amounts of I/O throughput. A single dual quad-core Nehalem processing node needs about 2.5 gigabytes per second of sustained I/O in random access patterns if you want to keep those 8 cores or 16 threads busy at all times. That's an interesting challenge to have, right? I mean, many companies try to build something out with 4 or 6 or 8 drives in a node and then are surprised if their CPUs are running 5% busy and they can't get the utilization of their infrastructure up. And so a lot of what we're doing is really about finding the right balance points in terms of how to match up storage with processing, with interconnect, and come up with these integrated systems. High availability, 24/7/365, it's an absolutely must-have. Our analysts are sitting anywhere from Germany, UK, all over Europe, all over the US, all over Asia. There's no such thing as a batch window that we have. We need to load and process data 24/7. We have users on the system 24/7. We need to do our backups. And yes, we do backups of multi-petabyte systems while loads and users are hitting the systems. So it's a very interesting workload management problem that we have to deal with and that we have implemented. And our users produce in excess of several million requests and queries a day. Very active community. Some applications are part of that. So for example, a call center agent, when they get an incoming call, they get all their lifetime scores and all the information about a customer straight out of these systems. This is the infrastructure that has deep history about everything, whereas all the OLTP systems, all the processing systems on the front end, we try to keep them as lean and as little history as possible to keep them up on performance. On a very, very high level, and that's extremely simplified, this is what our infrastructure looks like. There's basically two major clusters out there, and each cluster exists of consists of multiple clusters in itself that have a local interconnect to combine all of that. The front end, the high throughput, high availability systems are about 2.5 petabytes in a single image. They are backloaded with deep systems that are right now on their trajectory to multi-tens of petabytes. We actually spent the last 2 years on an internal R&D project with a vendor out there that is one of the leaders in analytical large-scale systems, and the project is called Singularity, where we really built a technology or co-developed a technology that allows us over the next year, 2 years, 24 months to scale that infrastructure into the 50 petabyte range for a single instance of a processing environment. We run multiple of those, of course, just for disaster recovery and fault tolerance. We front-end these systems with anything open source to commercial products like MicroStrategy or Unica for processing, campaign management. There's a lot of access where people simply want SQL access, and they get very advanced levels of SQL access. SQL access, for example, that allows them to do time series computation. One example that we have to do, for example, with clickstream data is sessionization of data. It's a very typical problem. What usually takes hundreds of lines of C or Java code to write, we do on these systems with advanced SQL in 10 lines of code with partition by SQL statements that do ordered analytic processing. And so there's a lot of different types of workloads. We allow C and Java custom code to be executed in these infrastructures, and we do the parallelization for that for our users. So the user never has to deal with the fact, do I need to run something massively parallel? It just gets done for them. On the back end, we use, again, many state-of-the-art technologies. Again, there's also a lot of open source usage in-house, but there's also commercial products like Avanishio, Golden Gate, UC4, that we use to feed the data and to operate the infrastructure. On that analytical core, we run... First of all, the biggest thing that you will see is that eBay and PayPal themselves run on that single infrastructure. And that was the largest one of our consolidation projects that we did about 1.5 to 2 years ago, where up until that point in time, PayPal was on their own separate infrastructure. And over the years, we just realized that separate infrastructures come with a lot of cost that might not be visible at first, but the duplication and replication of data and the interoperability of data is very limited. And so what you will see is an infrastructure right now that uses virtualization technologies at a very different level than most of you might think at this point in time, and I'm going to talk you through that. And so our analytical customers doing anything from trading, search, fraud, site analysis, finance, and they come into an environment that is focused around self-service with visualization tools, with reporting tools, with dashboards, but also with a lot of open access And I'm going to talk about how we enable our customers to do that. We have created a foundation that we call analytics as a service, and I'm going to talk about what we mean with that, how we have service-enabled analytics in a way to create an agile environment where people can come and do things very quickly without waiting for month-long projects to deliver insights and products to them. And we put this on a very highly scalable data platform. Yes, we started out with a traditional data warehouse, made it an enterprise data warehouse. Singularity is all about this high density. How do we keep hundreds of trillions of semi-structured records in an environment and give people easy access to that? One of the things that I want to quickly talk before we dive into how we're doing it is one of the design principles that we have for these systems is to design for the unknown. If you look at the types of workloads that we get every day, our technical people, whether those are DBAs, sysadmins, the operations staff, they have not seen more than 85% of the workload that gets thrown on the system ever before. When you run millions of queries every day or processes, right, you just cannot scale an infrastructure by having people look at every individual job or by optimizing every individual job until it runs perfectly, right? You need an infrastructure that is based on analytics itself, on models itself, and where you look at key performance indicators, and I have an example for you, in order to optimize throughput of these systems. So everything that we design is about not what somebody is asking today, but what people could be asking at any given point in time. When we load data, we don't ask the marketing department, give me your 20 questions. I want to know the 20 questions I need to answer for you. And I'm going to model a star model or whatever it is to give you exactly those 20 questions. And then 3 months later, we deliver this, or we don't, but you know, that's a traditional thing. Somebody delivers this, and the day that department would look at the data, they would come back and say, okay, now I have 300 more questions. And that cycle starts where you say, okay, now I need to redesign everything because you didn't tell me that you wanted to ask by seller or by customer or by this or by that score. And so when we design our systems, we keep data at the most atomic level we can afford. We only optimize for very common access patterns into that data. We index very, very lightly. I think to give you a perspective, these large-scale systems, less than 2% of our storage is in indexes. Compare that to a lot of other systems out there that easily go 50, 70, 80% of their storage is in indexes and aggregations, right? And the problem that many people don't realize is once you go overboard or once you have a technology that requires you to index that heavily, the amount of time that you sink into maintaining it, making sure it's the optimal, is very, very difficult. And so we just don't try that to begin with. For us, data exploration is key. The metrics that you know are the easy ones, right? Those are the ones that, okay, you can optimize and build. Most of the time, the metrics that you know have a hype cycle where the first time something gets discovered, that's great, a great return of investment. It peaks at some point in time, and then it goes into sustainment, right? It's the new hidden gems in the data that has the potential ROI that we want to go after. And we optimize our systems to allow people to find these. And so takeaway from this is design just can't be static. It can't be a certain data model. It can't be a certain indexing scheme. It needs to be open to allow basically every customer that we have, our internal customers, to combine any data element in the company with any other one and roll it up in any way, shape, or form that they see necessary. And so if you think of it, analytics, you have to have it in the DNA to be successful, I think. And I think more and more companies in the world start to realize that analytics is key to their success. And you have to embed it in your daily life. You need to do it bottoms up. You need to do it tops down. And if you look internally at eBay, we track key metrics all the way up to the CEO level. We apply them to any size of group. We have our own personal goals depend on key metrics. My bonus depends on if I hit the top 3, 5, 10 metrics that have been agreed upon with the goals on how to improve them, right? So we do a lot of measurement in order to make sure we focus on right thing. And we try to do it as much as possible without getting into paralysis. Just to give you a perspective of where we use analytics, and these are just some examples. In a lot of companies, there's a marketing system. There's a finance system. There's a campaign management system. There's a supply management system. Those are very traditional use cases. Some of the telecommunications companies are going more and more into network optimization. But traditionally, it has been very business-oriented in terms of the use cases that you do, right? And what you will find here, and I'll give you an example, I think that fits also this audience very well, is there's also a lot of technical use cases that are, in many companies, not explored to the full potential. I'm going to talk a little bit about technology operations and how we use analytics in technology operations with their data being on the same systems correlated with the same metrics that the business is looking at to identify bottlenecks, to make our infrastructure more lean, more lightweight, more optimal running. And there's a lot of data, obviously, that gets generated that you can explore and build insight from. So it's all about individual departmental objectives that roll up into corporate goals. And it's that philosophy of a metrics tree, a KPI tree, as it is sometimes referred to, right, that is really important. You need to understand how individual objectives roll up to larger organizational objectives and how they ultimately drive the business and create impact in a way that you want to make. From there, I want to give you a very technical example of a KPI. Anybody who runs large-scale infrastructures is faced with parallel processing, right? It starts with SMPs. Many of us that work on very large data problems, there's no way around MPP systems. But even the non-analytical systems, if you look at eBay, our site exists or consists of hundreds, if not thousands, of pools of servers, where every pool has certain services that it provides to the overall experience. And pools can be anywhere from a couple dozen to a couple hundred servers deep, going into the thousands, that perform similar tasks. And one of the things that we, a couple years ago, had a theory on is, how do we really understand how all of that parallel processing on a macro level is really efficient and is really doing what we want it to do? And we had a theory that we thought that, you know, with tens of thousands of servers, is there really anybody in the company that understands exactly how efficient these systems are balanced, how they process workload, how they distribute workload? And we introduced a metric, a very simple metric, of parallel efficiency. Just measuring the parallel efficiency of any system in the company that has more than two instances of doing the same thing. And the parallel efficiency, just on a very, very high level, without going too detailed, 100% parallel efficiency means every parallel slice that has contributed to a workload has done the exact same amount of work. Less than 1% parallel efficiency probably means out of n slices of parallel processing that you had, only one contributed anything to the result of that work. And so there's a broad variety in between, obviously. And at first we were just guessing. You know, if you look at that, what could our infrastructure be? We were just guessing, right? It's really only when you start measuring these kinds of KPIs where you get the eye-opening moments where you see, oh my God, all of a sudden you see the real problems at hand. And if you have 10,000 servers, for example, running at a parallel efficiency of 50%, you are basically throwing away half of that infrastructure, no matter how you look at it. It's half of that investment is it might be powered up, it might be doing something, it certainly is not contributing to the overall result as much as it could. And just raising that parallel efficiency, once you know that you have that problem, once you do the root cause analysis, raising it from 50 to 80%, that's millions of dollars of investment. And so we apply this metric on a very wide variety of use cases, including our own analytical systems. And everything that anybody runs always gets scored for these metrics, whether it's parallel efficiency, gating efficiency. There is a whole slew of KPIs that we measure and track and approve upon. So, you know, once you start tracking it, and especially these higher level complex KPIs that as simple as, for example, parallel efficiency is, it is such a powerful thing. It can it covers a million different root causes that can go wrong. A code rollout against the site at some point in time all of a sudden makes your parallel efficiency dip. In prior years, we would not even have realized that we had that problem. After a while, we would just have said, okay, we're running out of capacity. Let's throw more servers at the problem, right? Looking at it from a very different perspective has really taught us, okay, first of all, when does it happen? And then once you know when it happens and what causes it, how do you prevent it in the first place? How do you predict when it's going to happen, right? And this is really the power of data. Once you have the underlying data, and it takes a lot of data to calculate that. For example, we calculate minute-by-minute data, or we collect minute-by-minute data of every single equipment, gear that sits on our floors, whether it's a server, a storage system, a switch, anything that sits there, minute by minute, we collect the data, how busy it is, what it is doing, how many threads are running, how much memory it's using, what the network bandwidth is, anything that the server can give us, and we collect all of that into the analytical systems to do these kinds of processing. Let's switch topics here a little bit, and let's get to the real main topic of this conversation here. It's about the proliferation of analytics. And that is something that has been happening ever since people started running reports. It's the, I need to decentralize reporting. I need to create my report myself. I have in my department, I have a need today. I can't wait for IT to build me a system. I don't have 3 or 6 months. I cannot write a requirements document for something I don't even know what I'm going to ask about, right? That's a very typical problem that many IT organizations are faced with, is go through requirements with the people that are doing the requirements don't understand the problem. The internal customers that should answer the questions to the requirements don't know the answer either. And that gets into sometimes very, well, less than optimal relationships between those teams, right? Where IT says, you guys don't even know what you want. How should we build something for you if you can't give us the specs? On the other side, the business unit says, well, I simply don't know what I will be asking. I have an idea where I will start, but I don't know where it will lead, because the first time I'm going to look at that data, I will have 100 new questions. And so it's really about people wanting to take control of their own destiny, to not have to deal with months-long project cycles, to shorten the time to market, to do ad hoc exploration without having to explain anybody up front what you're going to do, and to do prototyping, right? I have an idea, I want to try something out, I might throw it away if it doesn't work out, right? And so a lot of companies, you will hear in one way or the other, we need data marts, or I need my personal database, or, and by the way, they're cheap anyway, right? And I'm just gonna run it somewhere in a server room, or maybe even under my desk, and all of a sudden you have those under the desk data marts that the company relies on to get data without realizing where that data is coming from and how critical that data can become. So that's a real problem that a lot of corporations out there are facing. And it usually leads to dozens or hundreds or more than hundreds of data marts out in an organization. And the biggest problem for most companies is these hundreds of data marts are not in a single data center, in a single cost center. They're not on a single budget item. The company never realizes how many millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars it is actually spending on something that is just cost distributed amongst everybody, right? And it's a very costly proposition. What happens in most companies is that these data marts over time pop up all over the place. They start in certain business units, and certain even in IT, and you know, marketing, corporate, fraud, finance. Everybody needs their own set of data. They also need very common elements, right? They all need, or many of them need, customer data. Many of them will need product data, equipment. These are just, you know, a handful of examples. There is, if we look at our own infrastructure, there is thousands of tables of data that traditionally have been duplicated, replicated in various versions into all of these data marts. And when we started having some problems with those data marts 7 years ago, some of the largest ones, for example, marketing had a very large data mart at that point in time. 6-7 years ago, a 15 terabyte data mart was a large system, right? It fell over. It couldn't scale anymore. We took it on and said, okay, how do we make a use case on how to bring this into our central infrastructure and keep the flexibility? And we were astonished that this 15 terabyte database that was sitting out there, once we were done bringing all the data into the central infrastructure, it was 350 gigabytes of net new data. 15 terabytes of a system purchased with millions of dollars in hardware and licenses for 350 gigabytes of net new data. Why is that? Well, the customer data, the transactions, all of that is already in the main systems. And so we started to realizing that the overhead might be way, way bigger than any of us had even thought. We were thinking, you know, maybe we have 30% waste out there. We started to realizing we have orders of magnitudes of waste out there in terms of duplication. And by the way, when we start comparing the data, when we bring it back in, and when we put it against the single version of the truth tables, like customers and transaction, all of a sudden the results were all different. We said, how is this possible? You know, this data mart has been around, it produces different results than when we bring it back in. Well, it turns out every year that data mart would drop a couple incremental loads here and there. And since it was a data mart, never got onto anybody's radar screen, it was completely out of sync with what our real systems had. And it was producing numbers that were actually not really valid, right? On a macro level, that was a small mistake, but once you drill down into certain customer segments, some of those numbers were completely wrong. And so getting that rolled into an infrastructure is very important. So if you look at storage, just in a very simplistic page, so you have these dozens of data marts, hundreds of data marts out there. Let's look at how they usually are set up. They need some sort of dedicated storage in order to be effective, right? And usually, once one of those data marts is out of storage space, there's no way but to augment that system with new storage. There's usually no simple way to say, the capacity planning team right now is not using their storage on their data mart. I'm going to grab some storage, and I'm going to use it instead. That's usually a very difficult task to do. I mean, depending on the technology that you're using, you might be able to mount some new file systems and do that. But usually, once you are dealing with any sort of appliances, especially, or anything that uses parallel distributed table spaces, just because a table space is empty doesn't mean somebody else can use it. Once it's assigned, it's assigned. And getting rid of it is a major IT project, right? And so ultimately you get locked in into a structure that is very, very hard, and you have hotspots in your infrastructure where you would need it most critically, and free capacity all over the place that you just can't get to. Let's look at processing over time. Let's go quickly through a day worth of processing going on these data marts. And it starts out with, you know, marketing. Morning does a lot. By 10 a.m., they're really busy. They're hammering their analytical systems. Finance and fraud are doing the same thing. But as you can see, some other departments, they don't do anything yet, or they don't have a need right now to use any of that. It's the typical virtualization story, right? It's like, okay, I have infrastructure out there. I have hotspots in the infrastructure. Those hotspots change over time. And at any given point in time, since I'm so hardwired to the infrastructure, there's no way for me to break out of that and leverage that infrastructure better. And so what you see is that these boxes usually don't change around, right? The largest corporations have that problem. Once you have a couple hundred data marts, every single data mart, every single analytical system, whether it is an Oracle database, whether it is a SaaS box, whether it is any sort of environment that you're running, once you lay it down, it's pretty much, that's the size of it, and that's what you're dealing with. And one of our best examples was, you know, finance. If the CFO comes to us and says, we need these numbers, and this question about these numbers is a multi-day job in order to reprocess the last 2 years of data. If you're in a data mart, you have no choice but for the next several days dedicate everything on that data mart to just running this process, maybe even have reload some data and bring something else in there. It's virtually impossible, or no, it is physically impossible, to upgrade that system overnight or in the next 30 minutes to make it twice as big or 10 times as big. And those are the problems that these kinds of infrastructures are dealing with. And you would be surprised, and I'm not sure how many of you are dealing with these kinds of infrastructures. A lot of companies have these problems. So the implications of these data marts is that they're very locked in. As much as you try to design them openly, they are locked in. They're fragmented, they're duplicated, they're redundant, they're very slow time to market. They might be initially very attractive once you lay down the first one, but as soon as you make changes and the infrastructure evolves, they just slow you down like crazy. And what we found is that it's not a question of I'm wasting 30% of my storage. It's about an order of magnitude or more of duplication, free empty space. By the way, most of the companies, including ourselves, if I go into our operations department and say, okay, how large is the database? They give me the count of disks that are on that box, right? And if I say, how much data is on that box? Well, it's 15 terabytes, it's 50 terabytes, it's whatever it is, right? If you ever take the time to drill under the cover and see how much index is in there, how much empty space is in various table spaces that are just not optimally configured because you can never make them optimal, or, you know, mounted data volumes that are just not full, you will find that between all of these factors and the duplication going on in a company, you have 10 times, 20 times, 50 times the storage deployed of what you actually need to host and process all of that data. It's not unheard of that these corporations only use 10% of their processing capacity of these systems at any given point in time. Again, just because it's so locked in, some systems might be running super hot, others are sitting there idle, not doing anything. And to operate that little example that I just gave you, you're quickly talking about 40 people running 20, 40, 50 data marts. Very, very large. And so for our internal thoughts, we have come to the conclusion that a data mart cannot be cheap enough to justify its existence. And believe me, as a company as big as eBay, you have a lot of vendors that come in-house and say, let me give you this thing for free. I just want you to use it. And we have come to the conclusion where I joked with one of the vendors a while ago. I said, unless you pay me $1 million a year to run this thing, it's a waste for me, right? And even then, I don't want to run it, right? And so that usually doesn't work as a business model with most companies out there. But it's This is our philosophy, right? We truly believe in that, and we have found it over and over again that this is the case. So now we just established that we need data marts, that we need decentralization. How do we do that? Now, this is where a couple of years ago we came up with, and at first we called it something different, of course. Nowadays it's everything as a service. So this is analytics. This is our idea of analytics as a service. We came up with the idea, why don't we adopt a way like supercomputers oriented, right, for example. The operator of the supercomputer does not care what you do with the processing. You come, you rent space on it, you bring your data, you process it, you run it in any way, shape, or form, and once you're done, you're gone, right? And maybe you have a long-term commitment that you use 5% of an infrastructure over the next 2 years. Doesn't matter. It's really a utility-based model. And so we said, how can we get to a utility-based model that allows our customers, our internal customers, to have total control over what they're doing? At the same point in time, how do we combine that with a centralized infrastructure that can scale and do things in a different way? And so the idea was, how do we enable people to bring their own data and perform their own analysis without going through an IT project? That means, and by the way, when I first spoke to my operations team about the idea of letting business users load data, create tables into a production system, it was less than an overwhelming response, as you can imagine, right? This is never going to happen. Oh, we can never let anybody do this. And on many technologies, it would be very, very hard to do so, because you can't rely on an infrastructure where a single bad table or a single query or a single process will bring down the infrastructure. You need a lot of good workload management to make this happen. So it started with very simple web-based utilities where people can upload data, all the way to fully private utility access where it looks to them as their own private database, and they can use load utilities, they can use any sort of processing, whether it's C, Java, SQL, to process the data that sits there. And at the same point in time, we allow them to combine their data with everything that we have on our systems. That's really critical, right? Because everybody wants the customer data, and everybody wants the transaction data, and everybody wants the product data, because they need to combine that with the data that they're bringing in. That's what makes the big business sense. And usually they would then have asked, give me a copy of the customer table. Well, that's a half of the combined customer table is nearly a billion records. I mean, copying that around is not a trivial task, as in the next 30 seconds you have a copy of that. In this infrastructure, we do just that. So this is about virtual data marts. How do we create virtual data marts in this environment, right? It's virtualization at a very, very different level, way up in the technology stack. I'm not talking about a virtual image of an operating system on a server. I'm talking about an MPP infrastructure that provides virtual data marts all the way on top of the stack and allows you to expand and shrink them on demand as you need. If you take that infrastructure to that same workday, what you will see is just like with any virtualization technology, even much lower at the stack ones, is that you can grow and shrink these workloads on demand every second, every minute, every hour, just based on workload patterns. And what that allows you to do is if marketing or if finance, if the CFO comes to you and say, I need those numbers, we can put 80, 90% of our entire infrastructure at that problem if we want to, and make a five-day long job run in 5 minutes. That's very, very powerful, because that gives you the flexibility to, at any given point in time, react to business needs, new priorities, trends that you're seeing, things that you could never predict will happen. And it really allows you to leverage an infrastructure much, much better. So what we have is a single MPP infrastructure. It's basically a single physical grid that runs and houses all those virtualized data marts and applications. Extremely flexible. nimble. Again, we can change workload characteristics in seconds. We can double the size of the finance data mart in less than 5 seconds. Think about doing that with a physical instance. It shares a single copy of the data, leaving redundancy and data protection for a moment out of this here, of course, right? There is a single customer table. Now, there is partitions of that have PII data, certain things that only select users get to see, right? So there's security implied over all of that. But as long as your security clearance allows you to see it, you are accessing the same copy of data. That makes it also very powerful because the technology that we're using does things like synchronized scans over data. So for example, if somebody comes in and says, I'm looking for something in a billion row table or in a 10 billion row table, what does the system do? It does a full table scan. It starts with the first block of data and goes through the whole thing, usually something that everybody in the world tries to avoid because it's so expensive, right? We do that every day, every second, every minute. These synchronized scans basically take requests from different departments underneath the cover, and if somebody else wants to do a similar scan on the same data set, it reuses the same I/O path, and it only reads the data blocks from disks only once. And if the second job was jumping into that kind of read operation halfway down the road, it will do the half part that it missed early on at the end when the first job is done. And so on some of our largest tables, if you look under the covers, you will see continuous cycle reads going on all day long. 1/10 of the storage. Yes, we have large systems, petabytes of data. If we have this in data marts, we would have 10 times more spread over tens or hundreds of systems. 5 to 10 times the capacity, the processing capacity per dollar invested. Doesn't matter what technology that you use. If you're going down that path of data marts, it just gets expensive with this, even with the cheapest things. The FTEs to physically operate that infrastructure I just showed you at our house is 2 to 4 people instead of 40 plus people. Very big difference in terms of flexibility and in terms of headcounts, which is a big problem in corporations like that. It absolutely has an unbeatable TCO. So we have various types of these virtual data marts. Very commonly used are prototypes and sandboxes where departments come and say, we have an idea, we want to try something out, and they prototype something. They usually get to do something within days. It's not unheard of within eBay that internet marketing, for example, comes up with an idea on Monday, and they have results by Wednesday. And they make a decision by Friday if that idea has any merit or if they're going to scrape it. That would have taken months in the past, writing requirements documents, having an IT department implement that, and then figuring out, okay, that was not it. Because all of these things are logical definitions and not physical instances, right? Testing, experimentation, QA, development. Think about it. Development and QA, for us, are logical things, not physical separate infrastructures. That way, I can actually use QA to run on production volume, data volumes, right? Typical problem usually is you have a QA box somewhere sitting. It has 1/100th of the data that your production system has. And then once you roll out certain jobs into production, you're surprised that they don't scale or perform as they should, right? So these are all logical definitions, not physical deployments. Analytics as a service 2.0, that's basically has been the on our roadmap for the last 6 months, will be for the next 18 months. It's self-service provisioning of a lot of services. It's putting SLAs out there like get your own data mart in 5 minutes without a human being having to touch a ticket or provision or deploy anything, right? Go to a self-service web page, submit your request and get an email back within 5 minutes from the system. Your virtual analytical system is now up and ready and you're ready to go load data and do something. We're working on templatized data marts that are that have certain use cases already built into them, like clickstream analysis, certain financial models, site analytics, that allow us to pre-deploy a template of data structures with the provisioning of that. Very powerful if you want to empower development units that work on new product features, for example, on the website, to immediately deploy new analytics as they go. Here's a live screenshot. I did that last night, just to give you a perspective. This is where I would go on one of our internet sites if I have an idea and want to try something out. It's our virtual data mart manager, and I can go in there. I have to agree to the terms and conditions, of course, like everywhere in the world. I need to name my data mart. I say where I want it located. I pick on a slider how large it is, and for everything up to 100 gigabytes, we require zero approvals. Once it goes beyond that, then we have some review and checks and balances in there where a manager needs to sign off, depending on the side, the director might need to sign off. I need to specify whether my data contains any sort of PII data, because that is treated very differently and it's locked off. If I have an expiration date, where I say, okay, I think I'm going to work on this for 3 months, you're going to set in here, which is also very important because all of the management of these virtual data marts is completely automated. When you approach your expiration date of your data mart, you'll get an email reminding you that your data mart will expire. And if you make it very easy to extend that, within that email, you click a link and say, hey, I need it for another month or another 3 months, right? But what that does is you will find that that's a very, very simple way to clean up after your users, right? Because in many cases, they don't need it anymore. And we make a backup copy, but then we do away with it and we clean up after our users automatically. So in order to make this successful, you really, really need technology that has virtually unlimited scalability. Obviously, when we're talking about tens of petabytes, it's not only about the data volume, it's about a multidimensional scalability problem, right? It's about concurrency of users, number of applications, number of queries, complexity, and truly about balanced systems that are balanced in a way where for every CPU we deploy, we have the right amount of random access I/O capability paired up with that so that these systems are always at the peak of their performance. You need very sophisticated workload management, and that's something that I think the industry is going full circle. 30 years ago, the mainframes that were everywhere had very sophisticated workload management. I mean, you could, down to the CPU second, decide who gets how much and not a second more or not a second less. You could, on demand, change the settings. In our open systems world, we have taken a step away from that. For many years, we have been living with high, medium, low, or with a single nice level of jobs, right? That's not enough. If you want to run something like this, you cannot work just with these kinds of very basic workload management rules. You need resource partitions. You need to be able to guarantee a certain amount of processing for certain user types, for SLAs. Imagine these systems are processing very hard SLA call center requests where we have to guarantee that that page that makes, let's say, five requests to the EDW, where every request comes back in less than 500 milliseconds. We have to guarantee that no matter how crazy the ad hoc usage of the system is at any given point in time. And so workload management is very, very critical. Queuing management, how many jobs of what type can anybody start at any given point in time? Combine that in a very multidimensional workload management thing. And obviously the ability to support application level virtualization, which is exactly what we're doing here. There's multiple technologies that can do that. I'm not about talking about particular vendors or technologies. I'm just want you to be aware of when we look at these things, we look at it from, okay, how much I/O can a particular system sustain over time? How much concurrency, how much storage, what's the level of governance, flexibility, CPO, just to give you a couple examples. And some technologies will shine in some areas, and you really need to pick the right one for the types of workloads. And in many cases, what we found is that it's not well understood in the industry, that data processing, analytical data processing, starts with very heavy I/O intensive workloads. If you do clickstream processing, you start with reading hundreds of billions of records. You're shipping data from disk into memory at very, very high volumes. And if your systems are not designed for that, they won't scale. So a lot of thinking goes into that to ultimately define what's the best TCO and what's the best model to implement these systems. And so what's the benefit of this infrastructure? It's primarily about reducing time to market, right? Projects that would have taken months for IT or development teams to implement can now be done in days, literally days. Somebody has an idea, as I said before, on Monday. By Wednesday, they have results. We enable the business with that to do agile prototyping. It's all about agile these days, right? People need to go through a lot of ideas and throw away the bad ones and quickly come up with what are the good ones. And if you look at it, it's usually a big funnel, right? You have 1,000 ideas, out of which one might be a killer idea. And what's the fastest path to get through that is take any borders and boundaries away that make you slow down. And so it enables our users, and we have adopted that phrase, to fail fast. Fail fast obviously meant in the most positive way possible. It's not about that we want to fail, but it's a given fact that any project that you will run in your lifetime has a certain risk of failing. And in fact, if you look over the lifetime of projects and over 1,000 projects, there's at least 50, maybe 60, 80% of projects that ultimately will fail at various stages or levels, or will simply stop being done, which in this case might constitute failure as well. How do I quickly get to that and concentrate my resources on the most attractive and most powerful ideas rather than wasting my time with things that I could find out are not worth it? And along the way, we eliminate stray data marts and we make it a lot more efficient. And we run with a lot less hardware and data centers deployed than we would have to. And so with that, I want to wrap up the presentation here, and I think we have time for some questions, and I would really encourage you to throw questions at me. While this presentation is not very technical, I have a very technical background, and so feel free to come after me with anything that is on your mind. Please.
Berg from the Technion. Two questions. One is from queuing theory, it's usually the case that if you operate your equipment at very high load, latencies queuing tend to extend, and that's visible to the user. And somewhat related to that, do you treat separately the hot times at which, say, a transaction is about, you know, a bid is about to close? You know, from the now as an end user. When some item is about to close in 10 seconds, do you put it in some different platform?
No, it's the same platform and the same plan. Because otherwise, the amount of data movement and shuffling around would be enormous, especially with the volatility that we have on our systems. Right. To your first questions, running systems hot, right? This analytical infrastructure here, on average, in a 24-hour period, runs at more than 90% CPU busy for a 24-hour period. That means that for 23 hours of a day, it's 100% busy, right? Completely maxed out. And we designed the workload management on these systems so that we manage for throughput, we manage for optimum concurrency. So we know how many large running jobs can be on the system in parallel at any given point in time without getting into, it's a fine edge of being utilized 100%, going into trashing, right, where all of a sudden the throughput falls off a cliff. And so we manage it to be right around that sweet spot at any given point in time. And for that, you need the workload management, because for that, you need the ability to either accept new workload at any given point in time or delay it transparently to the users, right? You can't make the user responsible. You can't tell the user, hey, from 9 a.m. to 12 noon, you can't run your jobs. No, we take everything in, but we have that queuing layer in between where we then decide, okay, right now the fraud department is already running 5 large simulations. The next large one that comes in will start the moment one of the first 5 ones has finished. And that in itself creates, as important as it is, that in itself creates problems. Because all of a sudden, when you build this infrastructure, and at the beginning we weren't measuring it well enough, we started realizing that we were queuing 5-minute jobs for an hour, and we were queuing an hour job for 5 minutes. And so it just didn't make sense, how some of the rules were set up. And so, again, we said, okay, how can we solve this problem? And we came up with a KPI we call gating efficiency. Gating efficiency is just runtime of a request over total time, execution time plus queue time. 100% means a request has not been queued at all and with straight processing. Anything less than 50% means it spent more time in the queue than actually processed, right? And so if you create that and calculate it for every single request, you quickly identify where you have hotspots, and there might be, and you start setting SLAs where you say, okay, for these types of workloads, my gating efficiency needs to be above 75%. Whereas you say, okay, for certain types of workloads that are totally optional, I can be as low as 10% because it's just, I just want to use, what you will see is that we tend to want to use all of the infrastructure at any given point in time. Because it's millions of dollars that should rather do something than have idle cycles on the disks, memory, or CPUs, right? But you need to do that with a very sophisticated workload management to not get into a situation where you all of a sudden can't do the critical things or they start slowing down on you, right? And so we measure, we have canary workloads, benchmark workloads running at any given point in time that we measure just like you measure site speed of a site to see, okay, are the heartbeats, is the system in that healthy throughput mode where it should be.
Wang from Ample. So since all the virtual marts share the same data, what if one job is buggy, damages data? How do you prevent others seeing the wrong data?
Okay, so this is a very good question. First of all, there's a lot of security that gets deployed and a lot of fencing off of different workloads. For example, if you get a virtual prototyping box, that doesn't mean you can manipulate the main customer table. In fact, if you try to, it will just error out, right? You have no access rights. There are production tables that you can read and do anything you want to do reading that data, but you cannot manipulate that data in there. Because otherwise, you run quickly into that nightmare of everybody changing everything, and then you don't know what's the real truth anymore, right? So the production tables are all protected. They're kind of in read-only mode for everybody who wants to use it. These virtual data marts are fenced off against each other. If you have a sandbox, only you and your team gets to see what is in there. You get to see all the production data on the system, but you cannot peek into another sandbox. You cannot take data from another sandbox because it's not production-ready data. It's data somebody's playing around with, and you would create a lot of governance problems if you start all of a sudden relying on a temporary table that somebody else created, and then the next day it goes away and your jobs break, right? So you need governance, and you need the proper fencing off in order to make that work.
Okay, another question. Since you use so little indexes, does that mean for many, many queries, you're going to scan all the data?
Yes, absolutely. There is a lot of different ways, depending on technologies, to, first of all, scan all of that data in the first place, but then to limit the amount of actual data that you need to scan. So, for example, our systems support multidimensional partitioning of data. And while the data is distributed on a hash, on a virtual hash file system, in many cases, the large tables have multi-dimensional partitions over that hash that, for example, lets you, even though you have 5 years of history of data, if you go into the current month, you're only looking at the current month of data. So it limits you against that. And by the way, then you might have customer segments in there, which might be a second dimension of partition in there, that limits your access to 1/100th of the data element that is sitting there. So there's ways like that. MPP systems, in our case, we use Teradata a lot for these large systems. One of the things that they do is they have hash-based joins on MPP systems. A very, very powerful thing, because if you have the same hash distribution between two tables, you can put, for example, out of a billion customer records that you might have in the big table, you create your own partition or your own subtable where you say, okay, I'm interested in a subset of 1,000 customers, my top customers in that category, right? In my prototype, I insert the table, create that, also make the customer ID the hash distribution. That in itself is like a secondary index to most other systems, because the hash join will go through those 1,000 records and pick the hash buckets on the large table and go straight to those records without going through any indexes, without going through any partitions. So there's other ways to design a system other than indexes that in many traditional systems you would use for that.
Thank you.
Rick Farrow. I thought I heard you say something about trying, running your system at 100%. And people I know who are running production clouds and clusters and grids tend to want to have some space. You know, like they might run at 70% because typically live loads are bursty, yes. And so you can't really want it 100% or you wind up thrashing.
Yes.
So could you explain that?
Yeah, very, very good point. So first of all, that is absolutely true for storage, the storage component of that. Mm-hmm. We try to have at least 40-50% free storage. So if somebody comes with something new, we can immediately assign free storage to that use case, right? Absolutely, you need that. Now, processing, you can deal with in a very different way, because even some of the cloud providers out there are starting to auction off idle time. And that's basically what we're doing here. We are saying there are certain workloads that have SLAs, and they certainly need to fit within less than 70% of the footprint of that infrastructure. But the rest, you can have non-SLA'd workload. As long as we have the spare cycles, we're going to process it for you. If they're not there, they will go away, right? If somebody else comes in and says, I need that capacity, on a moment's notice, these jobs will stop flowing, and we use that capacity for something that's more important. But that allows us to stick with SLAs, stick with the workload management, but at the same point in time, get the maximum benefit of every dollar invested. Because if somebody has a what-if scenario that they would like to run, they can run it, right? As long as there's a single CPU second available, please go ahead and run it. And we have combined all of that, and that's one thing that I don't cover in here, with an activity-based costing model, where for every single request, we calculate what the cost is to us to run that. And we bucket that up by user, user group, cost center, all the way up into the organization, where we know at any given point in time who is using how much, first of all. But we also have established processing budgets, where we say, okay, marketing, you have a budget of X processing. It's up to you to decide how you want to use that. We let you spike up to 150% of that budget. Once it's more than a spike, it becomes sustained, then you either need to turn something off or you need to come forward with funding to fund additional capacity for that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
David Chambliss, IBM. In your talk, the word cloud didn't come up much at all. And I was wondering what you think about the prospects for the way cloud computing is going as a means to address the need for agility and dynamic upscaling that you've had to address without using the word cloud.
So very good point. And the reason why I didn't use the word cloud, although we use it a lot internally for various terms, is if you, for example, look at the Gartner model of different levels of cloud and cloud providers, this infrastructure to us is a service provider into the cloud. This is a dedicated service provider that provides services like process data for me into the cloud. What we have found is that data analytics and data intensive processing, currently at least, are no match for any cloud. The reason for that is once you have very I/O intensive workloads, you need to bring the processing to the data and not copy the data around and get it to the processing nodes, right? And as such, try to take a petabyte of data and stick it somewhere, right? That is just, you have to have some really well-managed, well-balanced systems to do that. And for example, there is a certain ratio of I/O to CPU to interconnect speed that you need to have to run this thing as at a top performance. In a way, we look at cloud for that particular use case almost the other way around, where we say, okay, the way we give out virtual data marts, they might, for our users, look like they are in a cloud. We are that service provider, but the underlying infrastructure is dedicated MPP grids that house that data and that we grow over time to have enough capacity to do the processing.
I guess a natural question at a storage conference, solid state versus disks.
Very, very, very good topic. It's in fact something that we just discussed a couple minutes before. We are working very actively on that, but in very different ways than most people probably do. We're doing a lot of shared R&D with, again, one of the large providers out there, and we're not going to use SSD so much for caching. These systems usually don't lend themselves very well to caching because the data volumes are just too big to be effective in caching. But they do lend themselves to multi-temperature segregation of data. And if you look at these systems that we have, is they nowadays run with a virtualized storage file system. A hash-based virtualized storage has a file system that on the fly, first of all, that keeps statistics of usage patterns of how data blocks within these systems are used, how often they are updated, how often they are accessed. And based on those usage patterns, it migrates data from any level of storage of one kind to another. That means even within disk drives, it reallocates blocks from the outer sectors to the inner sectors because you get about 30% more throughput there. It goes from slow disk to fast disk, and it's going to SSD. The reason why we haven't deployed it in production, the amount of random access patterns, the amount of write patterns, up until a year ago probably, were not yet a match for SSD technology. I think that we're rapidly seeing a change. We have some prototype systems that we test, where we see that I think we're just getting to that point where these kinds of systems are now, where the technology of SSDs and flash is getting to the point. Also, we don't see benefit of traditional, let's replace a physical disk with a physical SSD, because all you're doing is shifting the bottleneck from the spindle to the controller, to the connection between the controller and the server. It takes a complete rethinking of that whole thing, right? Because all of a sudden, nowadays we see SSDs that can do sustained random access read-writes, 60% reads, 40% writes, in the 600, 800 megabytes per second range for a single device. The current storage technology and controllers are, in many cases, no match for that, right? And so, yeah, you build out that system and put 100 SSDs in there, and you get the actual throughput of two of those drives, right? And so there is still a lot of work, I think, that needs to happen to make that effective, but I think we're seeing that with the technology that we're deploying, we have the foundation in place with the virtualized storage file systems that allows us to migrate data behind the scenes without the DBA needing to touch it or without a user even realizing what it does.
Amandeep from UC Santa Cruz. So you mentioned that for all the data that exists in your system, you can you allow, let's say, SQL-like queries or custom Java code to run on it, right? So my question here is, how do you store the underlying data? Is it in the form of, is it in relational database systems, or is it a custom file system?
So it is more than 90% is relational database. Hash-based tables, very simple table structures, but those table structures can contain semi-structured data like XML, JSON, name-value pairs. So we only lay out things into physical columns that are very frequently accessed, and we have other types of data that carry then some semi-structured workload with it, but the systems allow us to process both sets of data at the same point in time with the majority is done in SQL and with user-defined functions that we write against that against those data structures.
Burns, Johns Hopkins. I want to follow up on this question because you're using a lot of expensive relational storage and you have relational users. But there are a lot of work and many advances on providing relational interfaces to scan engines or to object storage. What's the potential and how do you look at moving to scan engines, cloud file systems, object storage as a cost-saving opportunity?
Well, it's a very interesting question because the origins of that Singularity project that I talked about a little earlier, that we started about 2 years ago, was just about that, right? How do we find the most cost-effective way to store that data at the lowest possible cost, at the same point in time scaling it to petabytes or tens of petabytes of data? And while you're right, the front-end high-performance systems, we use those 2.5-petabyte clusters. They use 300 gigabyte, 15K RPM drives. Expensive by all means, right? Those are the most expensive drives that you can get. But they're also the most performant ones, especially for random access patterns. One of the things that we see is that there is currently some limited use cases for extreme low-cost storage drives. But in many cases, random access patterns usually make us fall apart on systems that are not optimized for multi-concurrency and random access. And you could say, well, let's just lay out all the files so that you always have sequential access to that data, right? The problem really is that as soon as you run five jobs in parallel against that system, as sequential as they look by themselves, they become random access patterns, right? And so there is a balance of physically having enough spindles, physical devices out there, and enough throughput on the storage systems to do that. And so Singularity is pushing us an order of magnitude below where we have been before. And that's currently, internally, the cheapest fully loaded storage that we have. Out of anything that we try, that includes homegrown Hadoop clusters, that includes anything that startup companies build on commodity hardware with, okay, the cheapest storage, we have optimized that Singularity infrastructure to be well below where these are. We are using terabyte-sized drives, for example. We're using SAS drives with it. But it's always about the right balance between I/O to CPU that you need to design those systems. And so cloud storage for analytical systems doesn't work for us. And I think I've now been at enough conferences where people have tried to put large data volumes into a cloud, and they all come back with the conclusion, cloud, at least today, does not work for large-scale analytical problems. It does for a certain use case. It does for, I have some data, I'm going to take it to a cloud and I'm going to do something. But as soon as you want to persist that data and start adding on to it and taking it into the petabytes, cloud is currently not a way to do that. And that's where we have those dedicated systems. And you can pick whatever technology, right? There's some technologies that work better than others. But If you look into the analytics world, anybody who does systems larger than 20 terabytes, none of those vendors runs that processing on cloud storage or on cloud or cloud-like infrastructure because it just doesn't scale.
Hi, Vidya Sagar, Sun Microsystems. For this scale of data, what do you look at for reliability? As in, do you use hardware RAID or some RAID solutions, or do you look to software? What are your learnings there?
Very good question. So what kind of data protection levels are we looking at? And it's a combination of both. Yes, we do use hardware RAID levels. And we use software replication in there as well. So we run anywhere from K-safety 2 to K-safety 3, 3.5 in terms of how you mix the different levels of data protection. Once you start realizing how much I/O, sustained I/O, you need to give a processing node, and how much storage that means. And so we're talking today, even on the deep systems, we're talking for a single processing node, 74, 80, 100 1-terabyte drives to give it enough I/O to process that data. The implications of that are moving that data, so losing an entire node, becomes more expensive than if you have a node with a couple hundred gigabytes of data, which is very simple to copy around, right? If you need to copy around 100 terabytes, that takes a time point to point between two nodes to do so. So you want some RAID level protection in there to minimize these events. You don't have to completely eliminate them, but you want to minimize them, right? And so, yes, we run RAID level protection on that. That also gives us performance benefits in terms of how quickly we can feed data to the CPUs. And then we use other levels on top of that, where we, for example, store the same data block in two different cliques in the same cluster, so that even if we lose an entire clique of processing nodes, the system doesn't even notice it and continues to run.
All right, we're out of time. We have a break until the hour when we come back for our session on Flash, and thank you very much, Oliver.